what's happening in the food world is that chefs and diners are demanding a greater variety and less oversight, and our regulatory system is not set up for that.
Hi, I'm Alexis Garcia with Reason TV, and today I'm joined by Dana Goodyear. Dana is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the book Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of New American Food Culture. And, you know, I'm really excited to talk to you because, one, it's about food. And, you know, it's kind of been an interesting intersection here in American food culture because we're becoming more adventurous eaters, but it seems like the regulatory establishment can't really keep up with that.
Yeah, we are heading toward a clash. And a lot of people would say that it's already happening. You have raw milk activists who are very explicitly at odds with government regulators and government agencies. And what's happening in the food world is that chefs and diners are demanding a greater variety and less oversight. And the things that are kind of coming from underground sources or don't have the same kind of regulatory oversight have that quality of sort of exciting, sexy, new, and slightly illicit, and in some cases. And our regulatory system is not set up for that. It's not set up for artisanal. There are places where you can see accommodations being made to this new food movement, like the cottage food laws that are popping up all over the country. But in general, the federal laws really can't handle this homemade, artisanal, kind of slightly underground aspect of food culture now. And I think that a lot of diners, a lot of Americans would be surprised at how much of the fine dining scene in this country, chefs that they have heard of, who are bold-faced name type of chefs, are really engaging with this, you know, slightly gray market economy of food.
You're seeing on menus now that chefs are using dirt, they're using ash. I imagine that the FDA didn't really envision that.
they're using ingredients and techniques that often aren't even contemplated, and they're sort of staying one step ahead of the regulations. But then these moments of conflict or crisis, you know, tonka beans a few years ago became, you know, a lot of chefs had no idea that tonka beans have been on the FDA not approved list since the 1950s because of an ingredient in it is an anticoagulant, and there was a concern that it could cause hemorrhaging. Tonka bean is an ingredient, it sort of tastes like vanilla, and it's used widely in pastries and ice creams in Europe. And chefs here, like Grant Acatz, a very well-known chef, 3 Michelin stars for his restaurant Alinea in Chicago, were using it and had no idea. And then their spice cabinets were being raided by the FDA, and it was that was now several years ago. But there are things like this occur frequently, and raw milk is another one, another flashpoint.
You actually talked about raw milk and a store here in Venice called Rossum. And their whole motto was, we're not going to sell it to you unless it's dangerous.
But what's interesting is that there's a complete inversion of the idea of what's safe and what's dangerous. And in that community, which is a very extreme community, why I wanted to look at it, the idea was, you know, anything that the government has come within a mile of is dangerous. That means that it's been sprayed with, you know, antibacterials, you know, that it has been chemically treated in ways that community is not comfortable with and feels is unsafe and unhealthy for them. And so the government idea of safe food and often the foodie idea of safe food is completely inverted.
You know, it seemed like you were a little bit skeptical, which may be a good thing because, you know, I don't want to eat something that could potentially kill me.
I personally don't take it to the extreme of, you know, demanding that I be allowed to eat food that's contaminated with listeria. I don't want listeriosis, but there's a role in my mind. There's a significant role for regulation in food. The situation that our regulatory bodies were set up to address 100 plus years ago was a complete wild west of food, and people had no idea what was in the can, and what was in the label was not what was in the can. And it was obvious people were getting sick, children were dying, something had to be done. But the way in which that initial legislation, the Pure Food and Drugs Act of 1906, has been built upon has really encouraged the industrialization of food, and it's really only possible for very large producers to comply perfectly. And it creates other problems, like some of the worst food contamination issues of the last several years, the cantaloupe, where many people died of listeria. That was a situation where it was a large-scale producer. And a lot of people now are feeling that smaller-scale producers who may not be able to afford the manpower to keep up with the paperwork that's required for compliance actually are practicing, you know, they're practicing safe food. They are doing things properly because it's on a smaller scale, but the problem is just how do you guarantee that?
You trace the rise of this whole underground supper club movement, which has really become fashionable, especially here in Los Angeles. Do you see that movement growing nationwide?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes out of LA, which is why as a somebody who lives in LA, I wanted to write this book. In 2008, we've had an economic crisis, and one of the things that came out of it was a sort of shift in how the restaurant business works. The four walls of the restaurant came down, and Ludo Lefebvre, an LA chef, did a pop-up that was sort of considered to be the granddaddy of all the pop-ups that you see everywhere now all the time. He said, you know, I don't want to get investors and, you know, do a several million dollar build out for a restaurant and then have to serve everything to everyone in order to be able to make that rent and pay for the space. I want to do a really specific menu of my stuff. It'll attract a pre-selected group of diners who already are into that kind of thing and are willing to take risks and are willing to be delighted and maybe not love everything and not be able to get the steak frites. And he did these pop-ups, and then that became a widely copied model. And then the underground chefs are able to use, like Wolves Mouth, he's very careful and does everything the right way, but there are tons of them out there. And they're using ingredients that are not necessarily FDA approved, and they can because they're not actually selling. They believe they can because they're not selling the food. It's often a donation. And, you know, it's a question whether that legal loophole will stand. I think a lot of people are waiting to find out and waiting to see how serious the local public health departments are about cracking down on it. But it's also true that it's a great booming business. And if you're paying your taxes, which some of them are, then does government really want to stamp that out? These are entrepreneurs, and they are creating opportunities for tourism, and they're adding to the cultural life of the cities that they're operating in. So I think it's a delicate thing. I think they're discovering that there are ways of being in business that are not the traditional ways of being in business.
You went to a weed party where cannabis was used as an ingredient in food. And first of all, was it any good?
I had to be a little careful because I'm a nerd and I was pregnant. So I was not being as hearty an eater as I might have been under other circumstances. But what I tried was all delicious. And I did a sort of taste and spit. You know, I didn't inhale. There were lots of dishes there that did not use the cannabis, but used a lot of Chinese medicinal herbs, which I also had to be careful about because that's strong medicine too. That was a really fun dinner because it really got right to the heart of, first of all, chefs innovating and experimenting and using ingredients that are not typically thought of as food ingredients in our culture, but have historically been food ingredients. I mean, the Romans used cannabis as part of a dessert, and there is precedent for it, but it's so unfamiliar to us. And then here it is, an ingredient that is actually a Schedule I drug.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, the DEA could have busted that dinner. And so it had all of these elements that were interesting to me, and then the dining population is interesting to me. You know, the people who are willing to take these risks, who are willing to take legal risks to eat the food that they want to eat. And I think that that's a really new thing in this country, that there are people who are activists around access to food and ingredients and food experiences. So it was incredibly fun, and it also just, it seemed to me to be so of the moment. And of course, it was happening in LA with LA chefs who are, I think, really pushing the boundaries of what's considered edible.
Well, it's very interesting. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And for Reason TV, I'm Alexis Garcia.